you know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bassell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital DVD, Tubi, Amazon Prime, all the places.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life, and I'm currently in pre-production on my third, Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep who used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative.
On this Thursday bonus episode, we're going to play the interview from episode 271 from June 2020 with writer, director, producer, and actor Leah McKendrick. And I thought that Leah was a really nice match for Laura because they kind of have similar backgrounds, like they both do it all. Acting, producing, writing, directing, it's crazy. And they also like kind of have most of, like if you look on their IMDb's, most of their work is like as actors, which makes sense, you know, because it's way, if you're a professional actor, you're going to get more acting roles and you are going to get chances to write and produce and direct features and stuff. But yeah, so I thought this was a really fun one. I actually really want to have Leah back on the show because since she was on, she's directed and produced her first feature as like a director, writer, producer, star, which is kind
scrambled.
Of amazing. Scrambled. And I'm like, oh my God, is it going to have theatrical release too? And everything.
It did have a theatrical, and guess who shot it?
Who?
Julia Swain. Julia Swain, the DP that I work with, who shot Speed of Life, who's most amazing. Wonderful DP. And she is an alum of the show, so it's an alum film.
Double alum. Yeah, so I just think this is a really good match together. I just thought, well, going back all the old episodes, I thought this would be a good one. So I'm really excited for everyone to hear the interview with Leah. Don't forget to support us on Patreon, www.patreon.com/MMIHpodcast. Also, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes. That is the way the show will get shared with more people. Reviews, ratings, those things are gold to us. Probably more gold than a dollar. So make sure to leave us a review on iTunes, but without any more further bibble babble, here's our throwback interview with Leah McKendrick.
Which project would you want to talk about?
Ooh, maybe MFA, just because it's my baby.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many days did you shoot?
22 or 23 days with a pickup day.
What was the rough budget?
It was $250,000.
And how long did you work on it from the inception to the release?
I believe it was about, I started working on it in 2014, I started writing it. And then we released it Friday the 13th of 2017.
And how many people were on set?
Too many. Too many people on set. It was very hard to move. I will say on our pickup day, it was like five of us. It was so few of us, and we moved really fast. And it was like we were all doing crafty and putting together art direction and holding lights. I mean, it was like a crazy, but that was the day that moved very quickly.
But that was the best day, right? I always think pickups are the best days.
I mean, it's hard because there were so many amazing people and talented people on the days where we had our full team, but when we were just had it like a skeleton, we moved so quickly.
And out of all your projects, of which there are many, how difficult was this one?
It was the most difficult by far.
Well, tell us why.
The subject matter, the fact that I was so foolish in thinking that this was like a, you know, could be made for this budget, and It was, I had wrapped up all of my hopes and dreams in the film, and I took things that you shouldn't take personal. I took them very personally, and I was really out of my depths. It was my first time producing a feature, and it just so happened that I also wrote it and was in it, and it just, I wasn't as prepared as I maybe should have been, but the truth is I might never have attempted it had I really known what was going to go into it.
Well, it seems like a statement for filmmaking in general, if we really knew what we were going into. So just to clarify, MFA is fiction feature that played South by 2016 or 2017?
2017, and then it was released that same year.
And how we met because you came to chat about the release of the film at Sundance, and you and your fabulous producer, we were just kind of brainstorming one day, but how did you end up releasing the film and how did you feel about it? I really want to dig into what the statement you just said, which was that you took things too personally that you shouldn't have. But I think let's give everyone just a bird's eye view of what you did first.
Sure. So I came in with my director, actually, Natalia Lette, who I love so much. I produced it and wrote it, and then I acted in it. It's a rape revenge film, which is just inherently difficult and requires, I think, a lot of sensitivity and thought and I think in a lot of ways bravery and courage, and Natalia had that. And I think for me personally, I felt so much pressure because I had put everything into, I had asked every single person I knew if they would help me on making this film, and whether it was finance, you know, investing in it, to coming to be an extra, to working on it, to, you know, in front of and behind the camera. I had asked everybody that I knew to help me in some way. And I think and honestly, that's how you get a movie made, right? When it's your first one, when it's an indie film, you're begging and borrowing and stealing. But it was like something as simple as the cops have been called because the trucks are taking up all of the neighborhood's parking and is sort of like blocking the way. The cops are called and you don't have the proper permitting, because guess what? The city of Orange is not, even though it's in Orange County, it's actually not technically Orange County. It's a historic district, which requires a separate permit that you do not have. So we're shutting you down. And I know that what's happening indoors is like our big party scene that has many, many extras that are friends of mine that I've asked to be there. And so I'm like outside talking to the cops, crying, getting on the phone with the permit guy, you know. And it was so funny because I remember that the specific day that I'm talking about, I was just like crying. Honestly, it might have looked like, you know, a way for me, it was like a way for me to get out of it. But I was just exhausted. And like, right, the last thing I needed was the cops showing up and telling me that I didn't have what I needed. And by the time I got off the phone and they were just denied, they were like, we're shutting you down. The cops were like, you know, we're just going to leave. And we're not going to come back this way.
That's really sweet.
And I was like, but I have to shoot here tomorrow also. And they're like, he goes, I'm off tomorrow. Are you off tomorrow? He's like, yeah, I'm off tomorrow too. He's like, cool. So maybe you just want to like move that truck away from this area. And I was like, okay. They're like, bye. Wow. And I like drive off. And I think they could just see that I was like at wit's end. This wasn't me like pulling out a card and being like, I'm going to play the crying girl card. I was like, this is my movie. You know, I'm head producer on this tiny film that I'm just like, we're barely surviving as it is. And so it was like the subject matter on top of that, the logistics of making a movie that became much bigger than yourself and trying to manage it and feeling very much that it's all your fault when things go wrong, and feeling that you're terrible and the biggest failure in life when things go wrong. And then on top of that, being like, what are the chances that this movie is going to turn out the way that I envisioned it when so many things are changing on a daily basis, as they do, which is filmmaking, because it's a collaborative process with many minds and, you know, everything. You're always just trying to stay afloat, even on the big ones, right? So anyway, did that answer your question? I'm sorry. It's a lot of venting here. It was quite an experience in my life. It was much bigger than a job for me.
It did the trick.
I hate to pry, Leah, but like, are there any other examples of things that you took way too personally that you shouldn't have taken personally?
Or just personally enough?
You know, okay, so this is an interesting thing to talk about. I'm more comfortable talking about it now than I was in the initial release when I was doing press, because it felt, I wanted to be really careful to not be disrespectful to Franny, who's the star of the movie. But now, speaking about it these days, it doesn't feel like it's in direct, you know, it's putting down my film in any way. It's much more just talking about my process as a filmmaker, which was, I had written the lead role for myself. And that was always the plan. I always starred in all of my scripts. And that was why I became a writer. I had become a writer to be able to write the roles that I wasn't able to get, and that I And really, like, to, they were sort of tailored to my strengths at times, you know, and especially with my musical stuff, coming from the music industry, not getting the opportunities I wanted, wanting to be on Glee and not getting that opportunity, and writing the kind of role that Hollywood either wouldn't give me the audition for or that didn't exist in the marketplace, right? So MFA was something that I wrote for myself because I loved my story, and I thought, okay, well, now, you know, I've starred in all of my web series and short films, now I'll star in my feature. And the truth is, I had a window. I shot my film at Chapman University, where I went to school, and I had had a conversation with my professor, who is a mentor of mine, John Bennett, who I love so much and helped me a lot on my script. He was like, look, I can get you the campus, I can help you with this, I can facilitate this, but it's got to be over the summer. It can't be while school's happening. When school's happening, there's too many clubs and teams, and as you might have seen, I don't know if you guys have seen the movie, but there's a lot, there's like the football field, and there's the art classrooms, and there's the promenade, there's like so many areas of the school, so it wasn't like I was isolated to one school at all, or one area in the campus. So I knew that I had to shoot it over the summer, or I had to wait a year. And after a year, who, you know, so many things change in a year, I was like, it has to be this summer. So my window was closing and closing as far as getting financing, finding my director. It was very nerve-wracking. And I found this director that I had really wanted. I had wanted her, but I didn't have a contact to her. And it was really not helping me going through, like, trying to get through, like, agents and stuff. Because you have this little teeny tiny film, you know, and that's partially financed. And I knew that I wanted a female director. I knew that I wanted a female director who had been to a top festival and had sold her film. Like, that was sort of the criteria, and it had to be somebody that I loved, like, whose film I was, like, enamored with. And the truth is that if you are a female director that has made a great film that premiered at a top festival and that sold, you're probably not wanting to do another little teeny tiny film, A, and B, a lot of the times you wrote that film, many of them are writer directors, and I completely understand them having their own stories that they're ready to bring into the world after they've had this sort of break in their careers. So it was difficult, and I found Natalia I had seen Bear, her first film that premiered at Tribeca, and I liked her a lot, but it was hard to get to some of these directors with this tiny film. And it just so happened, we asked around, and a friend of ours had worked with her and knew her, and set her the script. Her and I set up a call, and she was looking for that next thing to bite her teeth into. She had had a sexual assault experience in art school herself, and she just had this sort of cosmic connection to it. And the one thing that she asked me for, her one, like, demand, I hate that word, that feels demanding, but her one, you know, ask, was that she had been really helped by the fact that on her first film, it was Paz de la Huerta and Diana Agron from Glee. Mm-hmm. And those names meant that, like, CAA got behind it, and you know, she got some great press, and they had a really cool, like, vibe together, being kind of namier actors that you would never see working together in the same project necessarily. They, like, really had a cool vibe, and she wanted an actress that had maybe had some namier value. And she wasn't forcing me into this, and I remember, you know, Shin, my head producer in my mind and my heart, who is my mentor, was like, we don't have to go with her. Like, if you want to star in this, we can choose a different director. We understand what she's saying, but, like, this is your film. And a lot of people said that to me. But the truth was, by this point, it was more important to me to get my movie made than for me to star in it. And that was, like, the choice that I made, and that was what I was determined to do. And I said, then I'll play Sky, you know, which was a role, the second female lead that I loved her a lot. So we went into casting and finding the right Noelle. But this is a very long story, but getting to the point, which is the entire process from casting to shooting a film with somebody else playing the role that you wrote for yourself and that you envisioned in your head how you would do it and all kinds of stuff. That's tough and it's painful. Yeah. And Franny is brilliant and an incredible actress with a lot of natural talent. And I love her face. And I love her face when I'm working with her. I love her face when I see her on screen. She's got this really unique edge and vibe to her that I think in many ways I don't have. And I'm very thankful for her work, but it was still difficult. It was still really hard at times. And the truth is you can't win with a writer that was planning on playing a role that you're now playing, because I think whether they know it or not, something has been taken from them. And even if it was at their own hand, it's a grieving process that there was no space for me to do privately because I was there holding down the fort every day. But I think I felt really heartbroken if I was crying outside with the cops and couldn't see the scene being shot, because I would see it after the fact and feel heartbroken that I wasn't there for that or that I wasn't a part of that. Which is the case with producing.
Yeah, but you're providing such an important role by doing that, talking to the cops, you know, and handling those things. Like, I think, you know, it's just hard. It is hard to be away from your movie in that way, but I always like to think that even if I'm parking cars in the snow while they're shooting a scene, you know, it's like I'm doing that because I have to in order for the movie to get made. And as a producer, that's my contribution at that moment, you know.
Totally. Yeah.
Well, Leah, but does that impact the way you work with other people now? I mean, are you writing clauses in your contracts that just kind of protect yourself in that way, or how did it impact the rest of your projects?
Oh, that's such a good question. I wish I could tell you guys that it has ushered in this new, like, beautiful chapter in my career where I stand up for myself. Honestly, I think it did. And again, this isn't, I really don't want to disrespect my film or like my actress. I love both of those things, but I think it did take a big hit in a weird way. It did take a big hit in my confidence as an actress, because even though I had made this decision, I think in a lot of ways the people started to know me from MFA and not necessarily my previous work. So I think people were like, she doesn't need to star in her stuff, or that she doesn't star in her things. And I had always starred in my stuff. So when the conversation comes up about me acting in my bigger projects these days, it can get tough. It is not a smooth process. And luckily I have a team behind me, and specifically a lawyer behind me, that knows that this is really important to me and that I will sooner walk away from some of these bigger projects if I'm going to be sequestered writing in a corner for the rest of my life. You know, I'm not built to be with my computer and my headphones every day of my life. And that is last year it was that way predominantly. And I, you know, had to say, look, I didn't decide to act yesterday. I'm not a writer that's like, it might be nice to be an actress. I think I'll star in this. I have always been an actress. I was an actress much longer before I was a writer. I got my degree in acting. I have a lot of acting credits, and some, you know, I'm trying to find that line between where do I put my foot down and I say, if this isn't a role that I get to write for myself, then I'm not taking this project.
So I have a couple questions about this, sort of going back, like, you know, was one of the reasons why your director wanted a star, not just because it would maybe help the movie when it was done, but also to help get the financing? Like, or did you already have the financing secured without the star? Like, did that help at all, raise the money?
Oh my God, we still had the financing coming in as we were shooting. It was the scariest thing. It was such bad news bears. Never do what I did. It was so bad. And that was like another thing that's in the back of your head where you're like, is our money running out this week? Like, are we going to have... And it was really Shin, one of our producers, really like, he put in his own money. I mean, it was ugly. But I will say that the main motivation behind getting a Name Your Actress was not actually in the financing. Most of my financiers, it really wasn't about that anyway. It was much more, these were people that believed in the story. These were people that believed in the concept. These were people that had daughters or were women themselves and understood in the importance of telling stories for survivors. And so luckily it didn't matter much for the financing.
I just wanted to say that I had a kind of contrary experience to what you'd had, which is on my first feature, I was brought into UTA and they opened up their casting books and they said, who do you want to fill your film with? And I decided not to go with their actors, and I decided to go with lesser known actors because the lesser known actors I thought were better actors and fit my roles better. And ultimately, it did hurt my film, to be honest. Wow. And it might have hurt my reputation. At the end of the day, I made a film I'm proud of, and I made a film with good performances that like played mid-tier festivals and got like a good distribution deal. And I know you're being like so sweet and diplomatic regarding your director, so this is not in comment to what you've said, but really just in comment to my experience, which is just like, there are days where I'm like, why didn't I just play the system?
Sure. Yeah. I it is sort of like you and I were in a similar position, and you took one route and you and I took the other. And I think
you're writing Grease. So, and I'm in my bedroom in sweats. So,
but I do, I'm actually with UTA, and it is an interesting thing. And I commend you, and I think that's beautiful, and I think that you will be rewarded and probably have been in ways that are, it's hard to tell, at this point, but I think we are all faced with that. What, you know, do I do what's best for my film, or do I play the system a little bit? Do I play the game a little bit? And it's hard, man. It's hard to know which way to go. And I will say, I think that I chose right for my situation because my film turned out, and I'm proud of what we did with it, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't still like hurt me and haunt me in its own ways.
So then the other question is, like, when it was released and it did get into South by Southwest and all that stuff, like, do you feel like Francesca Eastwood being the lead role was the reason why it got into South by Southwest and had the success it did? Or do you feel like that wasn't really a factor? Or will you just never know?
I think it did. I just think she's so good in it. I think she's better than I would have been, honestly. I think that she was meant to be Noelle. And because it's not, you know, I'm such a big believer that some of, you know, these movie roles that we love, that we see, there's so many actresses that could have played that role and would have killed it. And we always think of it as, you know, there's only one Marty McFly. Yeah, there's only one, you know.
I mean, technically there's whoever. Two, but yes.
There's only one in our hearts, right?
Right. There's only really one.
There's only really one, but like, But I'm such a big believer that there's so many amazing actors that could play these roles, and that we get attached to the version that we see on screen. And the truth is, I too am that way. I have almost forgotten the day where I saw myself as Noelle, and that vision has been so replaced with Franny as Noelle. And we got so much amazing press saying how incredible Franny was, and that she, even in reviews that weren't particularly glowing of our film, they were always glowing about Franny. And I'm really proud of her, and I'm really proud of her performance. And I have, I don't regret my decision at all to step aside and let Franny take that part. I believe that it was meant for her, and I believe that we got it to South by. We had some of the success that we had because of her and her performance, and Natalia directing her performance.
We have like dozens of questions for you, but I'm like chomping at the bit to hear how Summer Lovin' happened.
Oh yeah.
Can we dip into that? Is that okay, Eric?
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
I mean, just tell us. How did it happen?
Well, I was going to say, for the people who don't know what we're talking about, like, to set up what is Summer Lovin', too.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. So, but I do think it feels like this one moment that happened much before Summer Lovin' is sort of the moment. And I feel like for me, it bugs me when I listen to, like, this really bugged me. I wonder if this bugs you guys. When I was trying to learn how to finance a feature film, I was reading every article and, like, anything I could get my hands on. How do you finance a movie? And it was like everybody was just kind of like, you're going to go out there and you're going to find financing. And if you work hard, you're going to find financing. And I was like, yeah, but, like, how do I do that? I need you guys to get really specific with me because I don't know how to do that. And it would annoy me when I would listen to these interviews where nobody was actually answering the question. Do you know what I mean?
We try to be as specific as we can on this show, like with our guests and then also talking about our own experiences as well. But, you know, as you know, it's like, you know, besides saying you met this person from this other person and this other person.
Right.
And then they happen to say yes after you right. emailed them 20 times. It's like, I don't know. What else do you say, really?
But I want to hear that, though, that you emailed that person 20 times. What did you say in those right. emails? Do you know what
right.
I mean?
Right,
and
right,
you guys
true.
On this podcast are actually awesome and do get to it. And, like, how do you break down this budget? And how, you know, how did you pay for this? And you guys are really great. But I think for filmmakers that are, like, trying to get to this to a certain position, it's, like, get really specific so I know exactly, even if it's not going to be my map, what your map looked like. So I'm just going to get into it.
Please.
So I, you know, I made MFA. I got reps off of that. I had already been represented as an actress at APA. So it wasn't like, you know, a big jump. It was sort of like, you got a literary agent. Here he is. I'm like, oh, hello there. And that was sort of like how it happened. But then, you know, I got sent on the water bottle tour of meeting with everybody. Then I met with Escape Artist. Oh, well, it's a little bit longer than this, but whatever. We're gonna focus on getting to Summer Lovin'. But basically, I got very, very intertwined with Escape Artist, which is a production company on the Sony lot. They do all the cool Denzel movies, Equalizer.
Fun.
And Fences. And they have just, like, the coolest stuff. And a producer over there has become a very close friend of mine, but we met on one of my first generals. We have a TV show together. We became very close, and I was writing this, funny enough, zombie pandemic film, and it's a father-daughter drama within the zombie apocalypse. It's non-linear in its flashbacks, and so there's sort of like two timelines happening, and it's difficult. The format is difficult, but I cared very deeply about it. It's very much about me and my own father. It's tough. It's not always rosy. It can get really, lack of a better word. It can get very tempestuous. And I was struggling with it, and people were giving, it was my first experience of having a lot of cooks in the kitchen, even in my own kitchen of my manager and my agent. Blah, blah, blah. And I was getting a lot of notes, and I felt like I was being noted to death, and I was losing faith, and I was losing my North Star, and I put it aside to write a rom-com. And it was a rom-com idea that I got just from watching my roommate's stand-up show. Another girl said something funny, and I thought, you know, my mind kind of like went down this rabbit hole, and I got this rom-com idea. And I was talking to Becky, who was my producer at Escape Artists, and I just mentioned, I'm putting aside caregiver, I'm gonna write this rom-com. I just need a moment, I need a break. And she goes, what's the concept? And I go, it's about a girl whose best friend is her life, her love of her life, and it's her little sister, and her little sister passes away from cystic fibrosis, and she can't get over it, so she keeps leaving her voicemails, and then the number is transferred to this kind of cocky real estate agent, and he falls in love with her through her voicemails and feels like he has to go to LA to find her. And Becky goes, great, you're going to send that to me as soon as it's done. Like, as soon as it's done. And I was like, okay. I wrote it in like 3 weeks. And I sent it to her at the same time that I sent it to my reps. And like before my reps had even read it, it was like on Sony's desk. Because they had a first look deal with Sony. And Sony bought it.
Wow.
And so preempted it. And so before it had even hit the marketplace, Sony had it. And it was funny because I kind of got a lecture, you know, you don't own this anymore. No sharing this. This is, you know, Sony's property now. And I was like, okay. And then it was so funny because since they were attaching talent and a director, and I think everybody was sort of like, what is this original rom-com that Sony preempted when Sony is sort of this tentpole old school studio that does Spider-Man and la la la. And so I think because of that, everybody was like, we need to read it. And then it leaked through the agencies, and which was like this beautiful thing in my career because everybody read it. Like, everybody read it because I think it was the mixture between attaching talent, but also just this curiosity of what this original concept that Sony would have bought was. And from there, I started getting a lot of like rom-com attention, which was interesting because it was my first rom-com. It was never something, a genre that I was like, this is my thing. Like, like horror films are much more my thing. I love rom-coms as a viewer, but it sort of just like spread like wildfire in this weird way. And ended up getting on the blacklist later on, and which was beautiful. And all these gifts came from the single script that I wrote in 3 weeks. But what ended up happening was I was struggling through the rights to this other project, and they were sort of falling apart. It was getting really ugly, and my heart was really broken. And the day that this was all going down, I get this text message from my manager, and it says, "Wait, you like Grease, right? Like Grease the musical?" And I'm like, is he kidding right now? Is he messing with me?
It's only like, one of the best movies like ever.
I'm like, he's messing with me, right? And I was like, you know that I played Rizzo in high school. You know Grease is like my favorite movie. And he's like, okay, I thought so. Hold on. And they're like, he calls me up. Paramount had called. And funny enough, PictureStart, which is one of the production companies, had also called because they knew me. Both of them knew me from voicemails. And I'd actually already met at PictureStart and really loved the producer there. It was so funny. She had told me that she had read voicemails and that she'd come out into the like common area of the office, which is this huge, like all the assistants are sitting there. She goes, "We're going to buy this movie. We're going to buy this movie. We're going to make this movie." And they're like, "It's already bought by Sony." She like had this whole big moment and she didn't know that it was, you know, it was just, you know, leaked or whatever. But so she had had this meeting with me and told me that she loved it and that they wanted to find something. And I was like, "Oh, thanks." But just funny enough, they ended up getting Summer Lovin'. So they had called. They were looking for a big rewrite on the prequel to Grease, which was at the time called Summer Nights. And I did not know who had written the original script. I did not know anything. All I knew was that it was kind of like a big citywide, business-wide search for who was going to rewrite it, and that it was going to be a musical, and that I probably didn't stand a chance. That was sort of what I knew. I mean, I thought that like it was great that the studio had called it, also producers had called thinking of me, but you know, again, I'm sort of only known for one script at this point because most people at this level hadn't seen MFA, and you know, this is a script that has been bought, but like, you know, has not been made. I mean, this, I'm like, I think in the group of people fighting for the prequel to Grease, I'm like on the bottom, you know, of the barrel. And I just was ready to go into battle. And I think it began with a pre-call with like with the producers. And I think I just kind of focused on what I love about Grease and, you know, what is nostalgic about Grease and why Grease resonates. And we just kind of chatted. And I think I got the script, and it was by John August. And that really, you know, I didn't know that I saw his name on the first page. And I was like, are you kidding? On the cover page. And I was like, wait, is this for real?
Oh my God.
And it was like really watermarked and like deleted as soon as you're done. And it was a whole thing. And it had been sent to me. It was going to explode. It was exploding link. Actually, now that I think about it, exploding link. So I could only read it once.
So it'll self-deconstruct. It was going to
self-deconstruct as soon as you
self-destruct. So sorry.
As soon as you reach the last page, it deconstructs.
Oh my gosh. That's so funny.
You couldn't print it. And it was so, and I remember seeing his, and I was like, are you for real right now? Like, now I think it kind of like set in, like, oh, this is like, this isn't some BS little nothing. This is like a legit prequel. And so I read it, and then I read, I think, the studio notes of like what the direction they were wanting to go in. And then it was just like a series, a long series of pitches, you know? And I will say, you know, it's funny. I'm like trying to navigate what I can say. I will say this. I got sit down by one of the producers, and he kind of broke it down for me, which was really helpful. He goes, I'm going to explain something to you. You are not an attractive candidate for this job.
Wow.
Thanks.
And I was like, I'm not? And he's like, no, you're not. He's like, I used to work at a studio. He did not explain to me at that point that he was like the president of Lionsgate, and he was the president of Summit. He was like he had not just worked in studios, he'd been the head of many studios. But he goes, I used to work at a studio, so let me explain to you how this works. He goes, there is a list of writers that do big studio rewrites like this. They are foolproof. You call them up. They know how to do it. You are not on that list. I was like, I'm not on that list. He's like, no, you are not on that list. He goes, but here's what I know from doing this for as long as I have. That the little guy burns you as much as the big guy. That nobody is foolproof. So in my position, you choose the person that is passionate, that you trust can get us there to the finish line, and you close your eyes and you hope for the best. And I think that you're that person. And so from there, even earlier on in the process, I felt that I had at least the confidence of somebody, you know, and I had the producers on his right hand. I felt that I had them. And so even when I had, you know, other producers to convince, I had the studio to convince, I felt that somebody believed in me. You know, I felt that even knowing that I had never done a rewrite, even knowing that I had one studio movie in the works and one TV show in the works, but I hadn't been validated or verified by the industry yet. My success was still, you know, in question. I felt that he saw me. So as I went through the process, working my way up the ranks, in the process, I you know, took coaching. They coached me essentially on what to say and what not to say, on not just pretending that I had done more than I had done, acknowledging that I was a black horse, acknowledging that I was new to this game, acknowledging that this would be my first rewrite, but you know, assuring them that I loved this and I knew this inside and out, and I knew exactly what to do and I was going to crush it. So that was sort of what guided me, to just acknowledge upfront my weaknesses and how it looked, but then to assure them that I had the passion to get the job done. And that was sort of how it happened. And I just kind of kept fighting through many pitches and many meetings, and then went to the studio. And by that point, you have the producers there with you, you know, backing you up, and you feel like you're a member of the team, and you're not playing tennis anymore. You're playing basketball. And, so then, you know, I remember it was funny because I went to Paramount and I pitched and I was really nervous and I hadn't eaten breakfast and my stomach is like trying to communicate and being so loud. So then I'm getting louder to try to silence my stomach. And I'm like sweating and I'm like pitching from beginning to end, like beat for beat how I would redo it. And I'm so nervous. And it was literally like a 2-hour pitch. And I can see my producers were like, oh my God, she has taken her sweet time. And I'm like so nervous. I'm like, this is not going well, but I think I got to get it all done. I got to get it all done. And then I finish and then I go home. And I was like, I'm gonna take the rest of the day off. I think that went really well. I got it done. Even if I was loud and my stomach was trying to communicate. And then I get a call from the guys, from my head producers. And they're like, listen, Leah, we want to thank you so much for your work. And I'm like, okay. And they're like, you're not going to be going to see Wick. Wick is the president of Paramount. And I was like, I'm not. And they're like, no, we're so sorry, but you've done an amazing job. And I'm like, okay. And they're like, because you're going to a draft. You got it. La, la, la. I started crying on the phone.
That's pretty messed up.
That's really messed up. Sorry. That was a very long story. But was that specific enough for you?
Yeah. Well, I have a couple of questions. How long did that process take? Like, how many pitches and interviews and training did you do? And, like, how long did it take to
get there? It was months, guys. It was months because I remember 4th of July. I don't think that I had had my first pitch 4th of July, but I remember being in Tahoe and I had notes in my phone where I was just asking my girlfriends, what do you remember about love at 16 years old? Like, what do you remember about your first, like, boyfriend? What do you remember about being in love as a teenager? And I'm adding all these, like, notes. So this 4th of July was, like, right around my first pitch. And then I got hired, like, 2 days after my birthday party. It was, like, September, I think it was, like, September, like, 11th, like, right there by September 11th. So, July, August, September. So, like, yeah, 2.5 months, something like that.
Yeah, it's not very long. Also, I want to jump in with this question because I know nothing about studio writing. I actually really know nothing about studio filmmaking other than what I learned from this podcast. But when you hear that John August has written this draft and you think of John August as like the world's screenwriting teacher, can you tell us a little bit about how frequent rewrites are and how even William Goldman and Nora Ephron, like everyone gets rewrites, right? Or can you explain like the idea of this seminal writer and someone editing his work and how this is very frequent, I assume, right?
I don't know, to be honest. I mean, it's like everybody's very shocked that John August got rewritten, but he was not. And when I spoke to him, he could not have been lovelier and really just so kind and not even really, he didn't even seem like that surprised, and I think he understands the process much more than anybody does, and so maybe that was why. But I don't know how often this happens, but I have been told that these big movies that are these, you know, these franchisey, you know, Mission Impossible, huge style, they have a million writers, and it's kind of like ushering it through. But I think John August is just, he's the master, and he's one of the, like, the greatest living writers, and I did have the intense imposter syndrome, like, taking his script and doing, you know, moving it a little bit with my own voice and my own sort of vision, I think that you gotta be a little less precious when you're on these big studio projects, because I think hiring a new writer is sort of like the name of the game, and I'm sort of like bracing for when that happens to me. And
it sounds like it's a compliment when it happens. It's like you've already hit this great stage, and you know, you can let go.
Yeah, for sure. And I don't think it was at all like, oh, we're gonna have Leah on because she is gonna clean up something at all. I mean, John August is the master, I think.
Well, you bring a different perspective. This is not to devalue you at all. It's just, I think when we hear that John August wrote the original script, we're a little bit confused because all of us kind of, I mean, I don't listen to his podcast, but everyone else in the world does. And so he's just a name. Yeah. So, so I was just curious. I mean, maybe Ulrich, you know, as well, are rewrites common in the studio world?
It seems like it is, from what I've heard.
Yeah.
And then the other question I had, Leah, was when you did this whole pitch process for 3 months, did you only get to read the script once, or did you get multiple exploding emails?
So I had only read it once, and then at a certain point, I needed to read it again. So I was like, guys, can I read it again? And then they sent me another exploding.
Oh, wow.
And then I was like, guys, I really need, like, a copy. Like, can I please have a copy? And so they printed out a single copy in red pages, and they like swore me to destroying it as soon as I was done. And it was like a whole thing that I needed a printed copy, which is so funny. But I still have it. I have it in like a secret space because I love it, and I love John August, and it's special to me, and I don't want to give it up, and I hope that they don't get mad at me for keeping it.
Well, and then when you actually start the rewrite, are you using the script like heavily in your rewrite, or are you starting from scratch and just doing your own thing with that memory of the script in your head?
Well, by the time I got the job, John did send me the writable doc, which was which was lovely and helpful. In many ways, I took the pieces and the parts of the original that I loved and that I was attached to and that the producers loved, and then I think I did start from a blank document and kind of cut it, pasted the pieces that I knew I wanted to keep.
Can you say, like, what percentage of the original draft remained in your draft?
Well, I will say, you know, the characters are all the same. The characters from John's version, John's vision of it being, you know, it's 1959 and he has a sort of new direction of there's new characters. Maybe not a lot of the actual scenes and the actual, you know, dialogue per se, but the entire overarching vision, I think, is still intact.
With
the what it's about and who we're following and the themes.
I'm dying to see it. I have a big picture question, if it's okay to kind of take a step back. The way you're discussing your career really feels like you are a player in the system. You have representation, you get pulled in these meetings. You have these terms like water bottle, you know, sesh tour. Like, I've never heard that before. These are all things that are fascinating. Oh, you've heard that? Wow. No, I don't know any of this. I feel very outside right now. No, this, don't apologize. This is fantastic. I guess I want to know if you feel you're on a track or if you feel the momentum or if it's just the way you've intellectualized it. Just, I'd be curious to what your experience is like being in the midst of all of these changes for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I do feel very much on track, and it is so what they say, where it's like, be careful what you wish for a little bit, because some days I feel really overwhelmed and a lot of pressure, and I feel very much undeserving and a lot of imposter syndrome, where I'm like, I don't even know what I'm doing. Why are people paying me to do this thing? And then a lot of days I feel really lonely and isolated, and that I just miss making my own movies, and that I just miss trusting myself to make choices, when some days it feels like every choice that I make needs to be discussed with somebody else and it feels inorganic to me. So sometimes I really miss my old way of making stuff, but I also... Look, it's nice to have paid off my debt. It's nice to be able to pay my rent. I mean, I feel really blessed that I have closed deals during this pandemic. I mean, I don't know a lot of people that like are working more than ever right now. And so there's a part of me that feels guilt about that, because I feel so many opportunities and it's nice to have incoming offers as opposed to going out and chasing things the way that I've always done in my career. So yeah, I do feel very on track in that sense, but I will say that sometimes I feel, you know, it's funny because my ex-boyfriend, he was sort of my first view into what it was to be a successful filmmaker. He was my producer on MFA, even after we had broken up previously, but we're still very close. And I would see him getting up in the morning to go to his TV. He would be on a TV writer. He was writing TV shows at the time, and I just thought it was so cool that he made great money off of writing TV shows. And you know, Kevin Bacon was in his show, and like, you know, it was so exciting. That world was so exciting, and I remember him telling me that he felt that he used to be a better writer. He was a better writer when nobody knew who he was and when he was doing smaller things. And I remember that kind of stuck with me. And I always kind of went, what does that even mean? And now I know what that means. What that means is you become a part of a system where you learn, okay, this is how you respond to this note. This is what's the note beneath the note. And how do you, what pick your battles. What do you fight for? What do you just, you know, just take the damn note? And I struggle sometimes with that. I struggle with wanting to maintain my vision and then having to ask myself, Leah, are you just being ego-driven? Like, is this just about you are refusing to take off your vision and try somebody else's on for a second? And I struggle with that a lot. And so I guess the dream is to have a bit of both worlds, a bit of my indie, you know, spirit where I, for better or for worse, make a choice and stick to it and maybe it works and maybe it doesn't. And then also, you know, getting to make movies on the scale that the studio system gets to make them. And, and, And that's what's really hard. I killed myself to make MFA, and that was not a sustainable way of working, the way that we made MFA. That was not sustainable. I lost a lot of weight. I was very unhappy, and I was drained by the end of it. But right now, some days I don't feel creative, and I'm struggling to make everybody happy, and sometimes I'm like, where is my happiness within all of that? But then I also have amazing producers and an amazing team, and I've gotten really lucky on the companies and the people that I work with. So I don't really know what the way is. I'm still navigating it right now.
I mean, thank you for that honesty. That's like a lot of vulnerability for one statement. Just a quick follow-up is, what about acting? Where are you there with acting?
It's tough right now. It's really tough right now because, you know, I've realized I don't really have a lot of interest in going and doing an arc on, you know, Hawaii 5-0. It's just not who I am, and no disrespect to Hawaii 5-0 or the actors that, you know, do more, you know, network jobs. Because the truth is that as an actor, you don't get to choose, and you're just wanting to work. And the only people that get to choose are like the Angelinas of the world, right?
And
everybody else is just happy to work, and you know, you make some good ones, you make some bad ones, and that's what it is to be an actor. And I realized that that kind of powerlessness is just not what I want to, how I want to spend my life. And so that has led to me being much more choosy about the kind of stuff that I go out for. To me, it's not about money. I will work for nothing if it's a cool, you know, director or filmmaker, like writer, if it's something that I believe in, it's really not about the money. It's about connecting the dots, and but that's tough to know. It's tough to know what's going to work, what's not going to work, and so it has led to my auditions just completely dwindling. And it's hard because I can very easily get swept up into my writing because I have so much to do, and there's, even aside from the assignments that I have on my plate, there's scripts that I want to write, that ideas that I have that I want to bring into the world. So I do feel that the past year, it has been, I said to my, it's so funny, after 2019, very heavy year of writing, I said, you know, 2020, I'm going to be on set. 2020 is the year that I'm going to find the balance between acting and writing. And obviously that has not happened. And so I think the answer is, you know, fighting for the roles that I have written for myself in my own projects. I mean, it's, you know, my producers on Grease know I have a role that I wrote for myself in Sunset 11.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's not a huge role, but it's a really cute role.
That's probably smart, though. You know, make it something that they could say yes to, right?
Yeah, totally. And I don't want to force myself into anything that I don't belong in. And let's be honest, they're young. They're, you know, 16, 17. And I'm not going to force myself into any of that. So it was sort of finding a place that somebody like me would exist. And you know, I have a role in every single one of my projects, whether I win out in that or not. And you're right, there are clauses in some of my contracts that talk about me being in the projects, but it's very difficult in early development stages to sort of like fight for something that doesn't exist yet. You know, if the role doesn't exist, or it's going to exist in episode 3 or whatever, it was a whole, you know, it becomes a whole difficult, ugly thing. And at what point do you just say, okay, we're just going to deal with it when it comes? And is that smart to do that? But I have told, you know, it's so funny because I get in these moods and I'll text my producers and I'll be like, you better put me in one of your other movies or I'm going to quit writing. I'm going to quit and I'm going to leave because I miss acting. I miss sitting in my trailer and eating breakfast tacos. That's what I want to do in my life.
That's
and
so
you guys
funny.
Are like keeping me in a cage, making me write all day. And look, you know, they've made it very clear at with my reps that like, it's time, you know, maybe it's time to write your Fleabag. Maybe it's time to write what is that vehicle for you, because then we'll go and package it and get it made. But like, you have to come up with that. So that's definitely whirling around in my brain.
So I have one more like specific question about Summer Lovin, just because you talked about how long it took you to get the job. How long did it take you to actually do the job? Like, you know, what was that timeline like?
It was fast. It wasn't, look, and here's the beauty of it, right? Is that it's a moving train. It's moving. And I got to work immediately on it. And it was finished before Christmas. So
wow.
I worked on it, sent in sort of an earlier draft, got notes, did another, and by before Christmas. So I was like done with like all of my work for the year, like a couple weeks before Christmas, and just like partied and had fun and just like relaxed and like did nothing, which would like now I'm like, oh my God, that was amazing. But, and I actually already had my first Zoom with a director on Friday.
Oh wow.
So, and you know, we were talking notes on changes to the script, so it looks like I might be headed into a director's rewrite on Grease now once.
Oh, that's awesome. Do you think they'll bring you on set to be the on-set writer, or do you think that's like completely up in the air at this point?
I mean, hopefully I'd be on set as an actress, and then I could be on set the other days as a writer, you know. That's the hope.
That'd be amazing. Oh my God.
You know, and I've told them, and my producers on Grease are the best, and they, I mean, look, we spent a lot of time together before I even got the job, and they know how much I love it, and that it's, you know, nobody needs to pay me. This is a dream for me, and the money was really never even a thing at all. I would have done it for free. I would have paid them to get to do it. So as much as they'll have me, you know, it's very exciting for me to be headed into the new direction with the songs. That's going to be really special. And that's something I, you know, I've kind of muscled my way into that conversation a little bit, because I love the music of Grease and the songs are everything. And so I'm just hoping that I feel very blessed that they're continuing to keep me in the conversation with the new director and a new rewrite, and I'm just going to hang on for dear life, guys.
You should mandate awesome. That Freddie, My Love, and Mooning be incorporated into right? the prequel.
Right?
Yes.
It's so funny because I think there's some like red tape as far as what came from the musical, the stage musical, and what is owned by the movie. There's some like red tape there, and we haven't really gotten into it, but I know that it's much easier if it came from the Paramount film than if it came from exclusively from the stage musical.
I am so excited.
Yeah.
We should wrap up, but Arik, did you have any last questions?
I just wanted to acknowledge something that, like, you know, what we just talked about for the last hour was basically like the dream story.
Yes.
Of Aww. Everybody. Like, you know, you make your first feature, you know, you toil, you sweat, it's tough, it's hard. I just went through it on my own first feature in December.
Awesome.
So Rad. A lot of what you said resonated with me. We had cops called on us too, and you know, we got through it. And so, yeah, it was really hard. It was a very challenging experience, much more challenging than I thought it was going to be. Because, you know, after you direct 7 short films, you think, oh, yeah, I can do a feature. And then it's like, it's not the same.
It's so true.
But I just wanted to say, like, you know, you finish this feature, you get reps, and now you've, you know, written Summer Love in the new Grease, like, prequel or whatever. It's like, oh my God, like you're living the dream.
Thank you. That's so nice.
And then like, I don't know, it's kind of interesting with the layer of, you know, the whole acting thing of starring in MFA and then not starring in MFA and then like where your career has led you from there. But I think ultimately it's like you have so much freedom in a way, because you can do all the stuff that you're paid to do and like ride that train, but you can also keep on doing the indie thing and you're just so much more better off for it in the end, you
yeah.
know?
Totally. Yes. That's so nice. Thank you so much. It's hard to look back sometimes because you're like, what just happened very quickly? Yeah.
Well, we really appreciate your honesty and being so open, because not everyone would be so willing to talk about it in the way that you did. So,
oh, I'm glad. I hope I just hate those interviews where people like say nothing the entire time and just kind of like are jerking off to themselves a little bit. And I'm just like, I really don't want to come off that way, because I feel like I'm such a South by indie kid through and through. And it's such a weird like journey I've been on the past like couple years that even I'm like, I don't even know what's happening. I'm just trying to hang on to your life.
That's awesome.
Well, the nostalgia is not done yet, because we started to do this thing where we end the show with a final 5 questions, but they're more of a big picture look at everything you've accomplished.
Okay.
But I'll let Ulrich start off.
So what's the first film you ever made, and how do you feel about it now, all these years later?
I think the first thing that I saw from beginning to end was Destroy the Alpha Gamma as my web series. It's a musical. and I starred in it, and I wrote it, and I produced it. And the way that I feel about it now is very proud but embarrassed. You know, it's like a lot, and it's a lot of me, and it's not for everybody. And I thought it was like, you know, Schindler's List when I made it. I thought it was like the greatest. I thought it was Casablanca. I thought it was so incredible. And now I'm just like, I cringe a little bit, but I'm very proud of like all the work that went into it by all of the artists. So proud, but embarrassed.
What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
To build it and they will come.
Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
Yeah, I want to be like Reese Witherspoon and just do whatever I want and star in whatever I want to and have everything turn to gold. And, you know, sometimes just produce, sometimes, you know, she doesn't write, but sometimes be behind the scenes and sometimes in front of the scene, in front of the camera, and have not really have anybody questioning when I decide to act and when I decide to be behind the scenes.
If you could go back in time, what's one piece of advice you would give yourself?
Ooh, to not have so much pain and anxiety and worry about where I'm going to end up, that hard work is going to pay off, and to just focus on the day and not be so hard on myself about where I am in life.
And finally, is making movies hard?
Nothing is harder than making movies. Making movies is the hardest, but the most worth it.
Love it.
Thank you, Leah.
And then where can people find you? Like, if they want to hear more about you or talk to you or reach out to you, like, do you have Twitter? Like, you have a website? Where should people go?
Yeah, hit me up on Instagram or Twitter. It's just at Leah McKendrick. Yeah, all my stuff. I'm like, I think I'm like the only Leah McKendrick, so I'm kind of everywhere. I got my website, Leah McKendrick. com. Yeah, wherever you want to hit me up, I'm happy to hear from you.
All the cool people refer to Instagram first. I need to learn to do that. That's like the signature of cool.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I went on Twitter the other day, and this girl had read voicemails, my Blacklist Sony script, and was like, did this whole thread about how much she hated it and how whack it was.
What?
Oh my God.
And how like she hated all the characters and how like whoever had it needed to do like lots of rewrites. And I was like, yep, won't be going on Twitter for a while.
Oh no, damn.
Like, Instagram it is. It doesn't force me to see what the haters think of me.
Evil.
The hate is real on Twitter. God.
The hate's real.
All right, so it's time for everyone's favorite segment, maybe just mine. The game. What is the game, you ask? It is a handmade homespun segment straight from the mind and fingertips of our producer, Eric Toms. Eric Toms puts forth a hypothetical indie film scenario and he says, what would you do, Ulrich? What would you do, Liz, if this happened to you on your set? Ulrich hasn't heard this question before. He's going to answer blind. All right. Hey, Ulrich, you're getting ready to film an indie superhero movie. You're very excited. Was that an excitement noise that you just attempted?
Yes,
you're very excited. Because after an exhaustive search, you landed a name actor for your lead. You had to spend the large bulk of the budget to have the superhero costume made, but when it arrives, it doesn't fit your actor. The movie is based off of a very successful comic book series, and so removing the costume would upset your fan base. The actor's window in which they can do your film is very small, so there's no time to change the costume. Do you, A, find a different actor who could play the role and fit into the costume, B, have the art department try and make their own version of the costume with limited time and resources, C, risk alienating your fan base and just ditch the costume, or D, other? What do you do, director? What do you do?
Okay, yeah, so I can't send it back to the people who made the costume to get it fixed properly in time. Okay, you know, got that. I would go with whatever it was, C or something. I would give it to my art department.
B.
To figure out, because there is a solution where you can take this wonderful, beautiful, amazing costume and you can take it apart, you can stitch it back together, you can make it work with our actor. Like, there is a world. And if my art department can't do it because they don't have time, I will find the money somehow, some way to hire a seamstress, like a local seamstress or whatever they're called, seamster, if for a man, I don't know. Seamstress is this, whatever. You know what I'm trying to say.
Yes,
man,
yes.
Or woman who can has the skills. Actually, I know somebody who would do this. This guy, Oasis, that would be really great.
You would call Oasis and you would say, call Oasis, got a job for you.
He has made fan fiction superhero costumes and makeup for Dragon Ball Z fan films. Like, I know that he's done this. So he would be my guy. I'd be like, and he always checks in with me. He's like, hey, you got any cool projects going on, Ulrich? You know, you got anything going down? So I would reach out to Oasis and other people in my network, and they'd be like, yo, I got this awesome costume. Needs to fit this person. It's a little too tight. What you got? And I'm sure we could come up with a solution to make it work. Or at least, in the very least, salvage the emblem, you know, and like the major parts of the costume that matter, and like get it reworked in a way, like get it on like a full bodysuit, wetsuit that fits our actor, sew it on there, fucking get it all going, and boom, you got your costume. Because like, I am the fan who would be so fucking pissed if I like went to pay for my superhero movie, let's say it's Batman or whatever, and there wasn't a Batman suit on Batman, I would be like, what in the damn hell is this shit, you know? So if I was making a movie with a superhero that like had a similar thing, I would be like, I am going to make this costume work if it kills me. Like, we are going to do this. So that would be my answer. What would you do, Liz, in this situation?
No, I think you gave the correct answer, but I do, the things that that I'm struck by is indie superhero movie. Just that phrase is confusing to me.
Well, I think of a couple of examples, like Rian Johnson's, was it called Super or Super something?
Okay.
Yeah. And he had Rainn Wilson.
That's right.
That's like what immediately goes into my head. And it's like, okay, you know, like if I
normally
was
normally in like a comedy world, right? Kind of.
It was like a super dark comedy superhero thing. Like I never saw it.
Mystery Men, you know, kind of.
Yeah, but like weirder, I think. Yeah. Okay.
So that was confusing to me. It's also like, if you are a project of a certain budget with a certain named talent, you have multiple fittings. You don't just have one fitting and then it's like you're done, right? So that's surprising to me. But
this kind of shit happens all the time, though. Like, this happens.
They're bloated, or they like, or they
or like they like
their
get
size,
this like
or
this crazy suit made by some like crazy genius, and they go to put it on the lead actor and it doesn't fit, and so they have to do like you said, multiple fittings to get it right. But like, you know, on a low budget, like you may only have one or two
the
fittings.
The one chance.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I wouldn't. Oh, go on. Go ahead.
I don't know. I was just saying, like, if you had 2 weeks before your movie, you have the one fitting, it doesn't fit. And the actor's like, okay, see you in 2 weeks. We're going to do this. I'm off to Bangladesh to film this horror movie. You know, I'll see you, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I would do the seamstress option, though I don't really know everything a seamstress does, but I would use wardrobe department. I mean, I don't know why we keep talking about art department. I mean, I would use the costumer or wardrobe or the seamstress to kind of adjust the costume. I think that there might be, I know you don't want to do this for every single scene, but there might be a CG option to help fix the costume in some way. And that might be interesting to explore. But I definitely wouldn't recast the actor. And I would, you know, I'd get yelled at by you if I changed the costume. So I'm not interested in that one bit. So I think that's the correct answer is what you gave.
The thing is, you're like, if you have like, you know, the perfect costume that's so wonderful, and then you have to change it to let it make it fit the actor, you're probably going to get shit from the fan base for it not being. Well, the number one fact is, no matter how spot on your suit is to like the comic, you're going to get shit from your fan base. Like, there is no movie that hasn't gotten shit for this costume, no matter how perfect it is. Like, there's always going to be somebody who's like, I hate this fucking costume. You ruined my childhood. You know, that's going to happen, you know? So you have to make peace with that. But like, you just got to do the best you can.
Don't understand. It's clearly not a question for me.
I am like in that world. Like, that is like, I mean, since I was like, you know, whatever, in high school or younger, like going on all the, like, you know, finding all the trailers, like trying to watch all the things, like super pumped for the next superhero movie, like that's me. So, you know,
I wish I had that kind of fire. I don't. I'm like, when's the next Lars von Trier movie coming out? I'm thrilled. Like, that's what I'm excited. When will he offend me next? I'm gonna count the days.
I think that makes you a smarter person than me. No. You know, yeah, I'll take,
I just don't pay attention to the details. I think what you have is, you're saying that you're detail oriented, right? And I'm just like, well, is there a cape? probably cape's important, right? Cape's probably important.
Get your nerd on your as a consultant so they can like make sure that like you are you know, following all the nerdom properly.
Yes.
Yeah, if you aren't the nerd yourself, you know.
And are there any nerds listening to us right now? Please send us a question, comment, or suggestion to
We're all nerds.
We're definitely all nerds. So please, all of you, send us a question, comment, or suggestion to podcast at makingmoviesishard.com. If you like the show, you can leave us a review. Those are super important. On iTunes, check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Freimuth, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert California Jones for doing our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. Thanks to all of you for listening, and talk to you all next week.